Welcome to the Driving Eureka podcast, where we share ideas and advice for helping you find, filter, and fast track big ideas. Let's go! Hi, I'm Trip Babbitt, advisor to global organizations on the Deming philosophy and host of the Deming Institute podcast.
And I'm Doug Hall, inventor, speaker, teacher, and whiskey maker. I'm also the founder of the Eureka Ranch and author of the Driving Eureka book.
This is the 13th episode of the Driving Eureka podcast. This podcast corresponds with Doug Hall's newsletter, in particular, January 17th newsletter that you can read at doughall.com. You can sign up or read the newsletter by clicking in the menu newsletter. This week, our feature story is we must all hang together, or most assuredly, we will all hang separately. The Driving Eureka book segment is on alignment and bringing divergent groups together. And our Brain Brew Whiskey Academy segment discusses the power of mission and the Dr. Franklin cocktail. Okay, Doug. So here we go. This is when you attend some of your seminars and workshops and things that you have going on at the Eureka Ranch. One of the things that'll strike you when you walk into the building is all of the Franklin stuff, as I will refer to it. And you have a plethora of statues and quotes and things, whether you're in the bathroom or in the main area. So it's literally permeates the entire aura of what the Eureka Ranch is. So
yeah, Dr. Franklin is in every room. Every room is there.
Yeah. Man, you might want to rethink the bathroom thing. But anyway, all right. Well, let's talk about this because it is one of Dr. Franklin's famous quotes. I believe he said it. I'm sure you'll correct me if I'm wrong, to the Continental Congress, that we must all hang together, or most assuredly, we will hang separately. Do I have that right?
Yeah, you have that right. And I am a Franklin freak. It started with the fact that I was born on January 17th, which was the same day as him, as well as my grandmother and Janet Barrett and some other friends. And so that got me interested in him. But then as I learned more about him, you know, being an inventor, being an entrepreneur, a writer, a scientist, it kind of fit my personality. And so I, like many, Franklin has served as an inspiration for many out there. And so each year when my birthday comes around, I have the books, the Franklin Papers, that have everything that was written to him or by him. The Yale University puts together, and there's a book. And there's a book, as he gets older, every year there's a book. And so I pull that out at the turn of the calendar and start to look at it. And in this year, in his 60th year, which I will be 60 on January 17th here.
Congratulations.
I made it. No, Franklin was at the time, it was an interesting time in that he was basically retiring from the publishing business, the printing business, with David Hall, no relation, who was his partner. That was coming to an end, just as I've stepped down from the Eureka Ranch, although taking a different role there. But he was off to new things. And one of the big things that he did come February was there had been a huge war, one of escalating tensions between Great Britain and the colonies. And Franklin, you know, was a guy who really believed in peace and coming together and resolving things, really resolved on it. And it hit me that this was about the Stamp Act that the king had put in to pay for the troops that were over there. He basically didn't want to keep paying for the troops, so he figured he'd get the colonies and he'd put a charge on all paperwork going back and forth. Well, this did not go over well. And Franklin was representing Pennsylvania. And, you know, as I said in the newsletter, in the course of human events, again, quoting something maybe, in the course of human events, there'll always be conflict between people, tribes, teams, departments, divisions, companies, and countries. And we have that going on in society today. And I'm not going to get into the politics of Brexit and U.S. I'm not going to deal with all of that. But that same thing is happening now, these tensions. And the way Franklin addressed the tension and caused it to diffuse, and he ended up being the person who testified in front of Parliament, and it was said that his words caused the king to pull back on the Stamp Act and prevented the revolution, which eventually would come with the tea and the other things that would happen later. Although Franklin, who felt there's never been a good war or a bad peace, was forever trying to resolve it. The way he resolved this, it hit me as I was reading it, is very much the same way we teach and that I write about in Driving Eureka in the book, and we teach in innovation engineering, and how we do it in the whiskey distillery, which was what Dr. Franklin did is he got the powers to be in London to move to a higher level. In other words, instead of the tit for tat, he got them to think bigger. He did a famous cartoon, which, you know, basically shows England kind of dismembered. And there's an arm and a leg, and it says New York on it, New England. Mm. And it's basically the decline of the British Empire, you know, tearing apart the British Empire. And he basically raised, and in the newsletter, I have the quote from his son who wrote about it, because he had these cards printed, and he put an explanation and a moral on it that he would share with people. That was his way to basically politic this thing. And when he spoke of this, he got them to think of a higher order. In other words, instead of thinking about your need for money in this, think about the rights of Englishmen. Think about the British Empire and the rights that all citizens have, and that we are one nation united under a common mission, that we are one. And he raised the conversation to a higher level, and he was able to diffuse it, and it worked. And that's the only way when we get into these situations where there's a debate between two sides and they just can't agree, we have to find a mission that is greater than ourselves and our self-interests, that we can then create ideas to bring us together.
So you have in here in the newsletter, you have this cartoon, which Franklin was famous for putting in basically his newspapers. As you mentioned, with the dismembered portions, which I actually was doing a little research on it because I'd not seen this one before, because he also did the one with the snake a little bit earlier. At least they believe it was done earlier.
That's right.
The dissected snake of representing the 13 colonies, basically.
Getting that were united, out there. Wanting yep. them to unite. Yeah.
But I wasn't familiar at all with this Belisarius, that apparently was a Roman general that won all these great battles for Rome, but was basically at the end of his life left on the road to begging as he aged. And that was kind of I was interested in the, I'm not sure even how to say it. It's Latin, date obolum Belisario is the caption that of the banner across, but that they were begging for money. So I thought that was kind of interesting associated with that. And this all has to do with the, I'm not sure if you mentioned it or not, but the Stamp Act, which was right. The tax that they were doing in the 7 Years' War. But I don't want to lose sight of the fact that they certainly were at odds, and their missions seemed to be coming together, and ultimately it led to war. But yeah, Franklin was able to, with this cartoon of all things, basically passing it out in England, diffuse the act, and it only lasted, I think it lasted only a few months before they repealed it, which is interesting.
I was telling this morning, there's a class at the ranch, a black belt class, and I was telling them the story. I was with an expert whose name escapes me, but he does scenarios, and he was down in South Africa, as apartheid was coming down and things were happening there. And he got the warring parties, and I mean, we're talking really warring parties here, together. And same concept, but a different method. He had them work through scenarios. What could happen as you know, free voting came and such things happened. And he played out different scenarios, and the scenarios basically showed total destruction of one side or the other. And there was only one of a cooperation, and he got them to agree to a higher order mission and purpose, and was able to prevent, you know, major bloodshed, which could well have happened after, you know, so many, you know, and you have Mandela and you have some higher leaders who pull it off, but kind of miraculous, actually. I mean, talk about sides. If those two can come together, and if, you know, then, you know, my God, we should be able to come over these little trivial things that we're debating now. But it is about going to a higher order. And you know, this is a method of getting to a mission that is greater than yourself. And whether it's down in South Africa, whether it's Franklin here. But, you know, when it only looks like war is the only option, when it only looks like fighting is the option, you know, or when you're struggling against things, what is the higher order thing? That's how you can bring people together. And that really hit me that here's the guy, literally on January 17th on his birthday, his partnership ends with David Hall. And in February, he's immediately out, you know, saving the world at the time from war. Mm. Of course, I thought about that trip because, you know, in February, I'm going to the craft show selling custom whiskey. Maybe not as
a different type of war, right?
Yeah, but Franklin was a good drinker, so we're going to celebrate him. But, you know, he was doing something of a higher order, you know. And we'll also be at the show with the community colleges, 1,500 community college people, and we're going to be bringing innovation engineering. So I'm going to think about that. But, you know, it is interesting that we have to come together and find that higher mission, whether it's in our family, whether it's with our spouses, whether it's with our kids, whether it's in our community. What's the higher order thing that we can agree on? Okay, so we're debating on these parts, but what's the mission bigger than ourselves?
Yeah, and I think that's one thing that we all lack and probably don't start there. I mean, we start to look at the differences as opposed to the things that we would have in common where we can get alignment on AIM, which is actually a great segue into our second part here, which is your book segment for the Driving Eureka book segment. It's time now for the Driving Eureka book segment with author and inventor Doug Hall. A system for bringing everyone together in alignment. So now we've discovered this need for a common aim, common purpose associated with things. So how do you address this in the Driving Eureka book and within an innovation engineering system and the systems in general on how you go about innovation and really anything else?
So yeah, it's for anything. But let's just take the company example just to make sure people got it. What will tend to happen in organizations when it's hard to make ideas happen, it's because each department, and sometimes in a small company it's a department of one person, is looking out for their self-interest as opposed to the greater interest of the total organization. You know, they're trying to make their department, and it doesn't help, I'm going to set you off here, that we give them metrics that their department has to meet. And, of course, every department hits their metrics, and collectively we lose money. You know, which is the chaotic thing because we're working across purposes to each other.
What?
you've heard of that before, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. See it all the time, unfortunately.
Yeah. So what we came to was as we started to do innovation through the innovation engineering community is we found that there wasn't alignment. And we did survey after survey, and we found alignment was the biggest problem. Not ideas. We could do ideas, but we couldn't agree on what we were doing and why we were doing it. Mm-hmm. And so we started to do some work on project objectives and different things. And come to find out, we found that there was this very large organization, one of the largest in the world, that had employees that I would say maybe not always, you know, rocket scientists with PhDs. sometimes people that it was kind of like the job they could get. And but it worked amazingly well. And they used to have a system of command and control where they would tell people what to do. They would just give them orders, do this. And what they did was they found that that wasn't working because the leader couldn't, in the complexity of today's world, they couldn't just tell them everything to do because there was a whole lot that the leader couldn't know because it was just happening on a real-time basis. And so they went to something called commander's intent. And I'm talking about the military, whether it's U.S. forces, Canadian forces, NATO forces. I've confirmed it with all three. They've stopped doing command and control and moved to commander's intent, where they paint the end state of what they're trying to do. And in one of their documents, they call it commander's intent, a clear and concise expression of the purpose of the operation and the desired end state that supports mission command, provides focus to the staff and helps subordinate and supporting commanders act to achieve the commander's desired result without further order, even when the operation does not unfold as planned, or quite simply, in the absence of further orders, you would know what to do. Mm. So what we're doing is giving them the purpose of why we need to do this, setting some boundaries around it, and then getting them to think. You know, so many times we hire employees and then because they're smart, but then we don't allow them to think because we just tell them what to do. This is about using their brains, which creates more engagement, sets off a whole chain reaction. So in the innovation engineering community, this ended up being called the blue card, because the card was blue. And innovation engineering is blue, and we said it's so important we're going to give our color to this because this is the higher order bit. This gives us the mission, and it creates a shared sense of mission of what it is that we're doing. Why are we doing this thing? You know, what is important? And so the blue card itself starts out with a name that is suggestive of the mission, and then it includes the biggest space is the narrative. And the narrative is, why are we doing this? It sets the background. It helps somebody understand how their work fits in. Why is this of overall importance? When it gets hard, slogging through wherever in the military or working through on a project, why? What is the higher order bit that we're trying to do? Why does this really matter to me? And then it says the mission. We need ideas for and blank and one thing. And that's the higher thing. What do we need ideas for? Not three things, one thing. Then we set some boundaries. The leadership sets the boundaries. Here's the strategic and tactical. So here's the strategic. We don't want ideas for these kind of things. By defining what we don't want, that helps us understand what we do want. Hmm. And then the tactical boundaries, time, money. You know, we only have this much money. We have to do it this fast. I mean, the reality. And then lastly, we give some stimulus of some things that we might think of to consider. And it could be existing things or others. But this blue card serves to get everybody aligned on what we're doing and why we're doing it. And it gives purpose to the work, and it gives purpose to our business, and it creates the alignment. In effect, that's what Dr. Franklin did when he moved them up to the greatness of the British Empire and that we are all Englishmen and the shared values that we all have together, as opposed to we were these other things over on the other side of the ocean. He got them to think of it as a greater purpose.
Okay. So there's a couple things I want to draw out on this, and one is just pure curiosity. Was it the blue card first, or was that it just happened to be blue, and then everybody started calling it the blue card? Was there intent there? I mean, as far as the did you pick blue intentionally, or was
yeah,
it just
we did. It, no? It was an intentional decision. And actually, what happened? Interestingly. Okay, I'll fess up. It's my birthday. I'll fess up. So here's what happened. One of my bright young people working for me, we were I can remember it because I can feel the pain. You know, here I'm the CEO, right? And we're sitting, we were in Bangor, Maine, and we were running an event up there with the University of Maine. And we're sitting there and we're having a cocktail. And she was talking to me about a project she was working on. And I said, well, we're going to have to stop that project. And now this is a very open lady, a very smart lady. If you can imagine the scene, her legs quickly crossed, her arms crossed across her chest. And I said, are you okay with that? And she says, yeah, I'm okay with it. With a bit of a puckered, you know? And I'm like going, you know, she's a lady you love to play poker with, you know? She's out there. She's just wonderful. She's just a wonderful lady. She runs our education team. And she was just like, and finally she says, well, how could I have known? Because I explained the issue. She said, how could I have known that? And it was such an honest question. And now I'm looking at myself and like going, the emperor's got no clothes on and the emperor be me. I'm like a numbnuts here. Because I realized there was no way for her to know that there was a strategic issue or a boundary on this thing because she couldn't read my mind. Mm-hmm. And here she'd spent a whole lot of time, or let's say it more directly, she'd wasted a whole lot of time because I hadn't given clarity to the mission. She didn't understand what she knew what to do. She didn't know why to do it. And she didn't know the boundaries. Hmm. And it was at that moment that I realized, my God, we got to do something about this. And this had been percolating up. We'd heard complaints from people. There were issues and there were different things people were talking about. They were running into this problem. People would come up with a miracle idea and then they would take it to their boss. And the boss said, I was kidding. No, I'm not really interested in that. and they're like, I just did a freaking miracle and you're like dishing me here, man. This isn't working for me. And so quickly we started to put it together. And interestingly, we had a tendency, as we do today, to run experiments and we would pilot it with early adopters to get the bugs out. This thing, literally within 2 weeks, it was out in the entire network. And it was literally changing weekly as we would get better wording and more precise wording. And people just grabbed it. So it pulled out of us so quickly. I joked that if I hadn't put it out, they would have bootlegged it out because they were so desperate to get alignment mm-hmm. between what leadership's strategy is and what work you want me to do.
And
it was that shocking to me that made me realize that we had to do something. And you talk to people who do innovation engineering, they'll say the most important thing in the entire thing is the blue card. Nothing's more important than the blue card.
I would agree. And actually, that's a good segue into the narrative question that I have, which is, so in the old days, when I first started doing and working with Deming's philosophy, I used to do alignment in organizations. So you would have the executive team would have probably what would have been my version of a blue card. There's a lot of things missing from it, but in essence, it was mission, vision, values, and key measurements, as well as a system map of the executive team, which did everything. And then each department then did a system map that would feed into that and alignment and things. And what I've discovered in going through that process is, yep, I did a system map and they're all supposed to be aligned, but they weren't. And so I rethought it actually and went back through and started to build just one aim, not an aim for the departments and the, you know, all the nested groups that are under the executive team. And I started to find that that worked better. But I'll tell you the one thing that really stood out in my mind in advancement when I went to one of your courses was the narrative piece. That was the difference maker in my mind. That was one of the missing pieces to working with organizations and communicating with them, that there has to be this compelling underlying reason that you want to do something, that there has to be this narrative, as you put it. And so, Doug, when you put the narrative together, where did that come from and how did you get there? I that was one of the things that just it's important, and I hope people listening will understand the importance of narrative.
So we started to put the card together, right? And we had some elements to the card. And I was working with Gojo Industries. Mm. They're the folks that make Purell.
Sure.
And it's an amazing company, privately held. And Joe Canfer is the chairman and the CEO. And we were showing him this blue card we had. And it talked about the objective and, you know, the kind of stuff that you'd normally do, you know, like aim and metrics and stuff like that, like we do with systems. And he takes the card and he throws it on the table and he says, this isn't going to work. People are motivated by narratives, not by metrics. And I just stopped. And he says, I built Purell because I told people the story of how people get sick because they don't wash their hands in the situations where they can't. And that with Purell, we're going to make it so people aren't going to get sick. Mm-hmm. And he says, and throughout my career, it's been stories that motivate people to do impossible things. And I said, wow, that's, and I'm like writing furiously. He says, I want, interestingly, he said, I want credit for that. So Joe, I'm giving you credit right now. And I put it in the book because it was this incredible entrepreneur who's done an amazing thing building that company. One of the smartest business people I've ever met in my life. And he said, it's the narrative. That's the thing that matters. And then it was later than that that we found out that the military was doing the same thing. And interestingly, the military, you can't outsource writing the narrative. The leader has to write it themselves in their words. They think it's that important. And that's harder in the corporate world because people don't want to write. They want to have somebody do it and they'll review it. But in the military, the leader has to write it. And then as it goes down the line, as it gets into sub-blue cards, those people have to write it and how their department fits into the greater whole, if it's a tiered type system. But, you know, it is that thing that brings us together, and it is the difference. And I'm not going to beat on it, but you know what I'm talking about here. It's the difference between management and leadership. Mm-hmm. Leaders inspire people to do great things. Blue cards are a tool to help leaders turn their dreams into reality, to make things happen, to activate the masses. I mean, it is invaluable. If you want to become a better manager or leader tomorrow, put in blue cards. And when you have to write why, it really forces you to think. And, you know, sometimes you start to write why, and the why is so I can get my bonus. Well, and then we don't know why people are not motivated and engaged in our companies. Why could that be? I guess they're not stupid. I guess if we hired stupid people, they would be motivated. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. You know, it's interesting. I'm sure this may be a whole probably newsletter on its own, but I just did a Deming Lens, which I, my podcast for the Deming Institute, on the need of, you know, how you develop leaders from a Deming perspective. And one of the things that comes out of that Dr. Deming railed against was this whole concept of many executives and managers are not familiar with the work in which they're managing, you know, making decisions on. And, you know, conceptually, the blue card gives you the opportunity to have to know something about the work in order to write a good narrative. Because if you don't, it's just going to sound like mumble jumble. And I found that in working with some clients.
Yeah.
I mean, they have to really know the business. If they don't know
management by spreadsheet.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, I innovate. What do you want me to do? I don't know. Innovate. Well, where do you want me to innovate? They go, well, I don't know. What do you want me to do? I don't know. I'll tell you when I see it. So just try some stuff.
Well, right. Just make sure you hit this number because I got to get my quarterly bonus. And right. It's not very inspiring.
No. And it can become so complicated. I mean, you know, where we can spend, you know, 9 months writing our strategy, and then we give the team 3 months to do something, you know, and then we start the process all over again. This is simple. It's a blue card. We need ideas for it. And here's why this is important, and here's the boundaries on it. That's it. Got it, man. I mean, people want to do great things. They want to do cool stuff. You know, we got to think hard about what the mission is and then get out of their way and let them do it.
Right. So just a note to the people that always ask me, where did the narrative thing come from? And I always say Doug Hall. Now you know where it really came from. It came from Joe at Gojo.
Yep, that's right. Joe's the man.
Very good.
Yeah, smarter than me.
Well, you learn, actually, you know, when you're working with clients, they teach you things as well as you teaching them. So that's it's right. Always that's how you gain knowledge and further yourself as well as your organization. Okay, well, let's move on to our Brain Brew Whiskey Academy. This is the Brain Brew Whiskey Academy podcast, where we will take you behind the scenes so you can see what it takes to build a whiskey distillery business. The Eureka Ranch team, led by Doug Hall, are creating a craft whiskey company with patented technology like has never been done before. The power of mission. So how does this play in a distillery, Doug? We've talked now about the need for the mission, the need for alignment. You're now going to, where the rubber meets the road at your distillery. How does this play?
Okay, so we start this distillery, right? We got this time compression technology. Allows us to basically, you can now make whiskey as fast and as easy as you can make gin or vodka, okay? Because normally you have to wait years, and we can do it quickly and make world-class stuff. So you got this technology. The question is, to what end? What are you going to do with it? I mean, what's the purpose of it? Mm. Okay, so you got it. Why is it here? And what we, early on with the Brain Brew company, we spent a bunch of time thinking about it, because the first thought was, oh, we'll just do cheap, expensive stuff. We'll take expensive things and clone them. And we could do that. I mean, we proved that we could do that. But then we were like, that didn't feed our soul. It just didn't seem exciting. And being the cheap clone just didn't seem to really do much for me. I was just like, whatever. And so then we started to think about the different things we could be. And when you look at the craft distilling market or the craft beer business, you can have a number of different missions. You can turn around and focus your energy on building a brand, mm-hmm. and taking it national and global and building a brand business. You could turn around and say, no, I'm just going to be a really cool tasting room, restaurant, bar, venue-based business. But you got to make a choice. And the challenge many people have is they don't make that choice. They don't set the mission of what it's going to be. And in our case, this line came to us, and I'm not sure who it came from, but somebody, we were creating whiskeys, and somebody said, you know, this is so much fun to do this. And somebody then said, you know, everybody deserves to have their own whiskey. And I was like, huh, mm-hmm. that's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be cool if everybody could have the joy of crafting their own whiskey, and you go over their house and they go, here, why don't you have a little taste with this? Or here, I'm going to make you a cocktail with my special whiskey. I think you're going to like it. How cool would that be? You know, that's like that idea that you have when you're doing brainstorming and somebody says, wouldn't it be neat if everybody could have their own whiskey? And you go, yeah, that'd be awesome. But get real. And we'd figured out that we had figured out how to make whiskey a bottle at a time for our rapid testing, and, you know, that we've talked about earlier in this podcast. And I'm like, but we can. And we can do it efficiently. And so we started to play with that idea, and our mission became, and we changed the company name to Brain Brew Custom Whiskey. People say, what do? Custom whiskey. We enable you to have your own. And as it turns out, before Prohibition, almost every bar, every restaurant, every person had their own whiskey. because that's the way it was. People would blend whiskeys together and they'd have their own whiskey. I mean, it was a common thing to do. After Prohibition, it became, you know, the big companies owning it, obviously. But the idea of custom whiskey became our purpose. And how could we do that? How could we bring together? And then we chose, if you look at the spelling in online and you see it, you see parentheses around the E. Mm-hmm. And we may have talked about this before, but it's worth bringing up again, because whiskey tends to be tribal. You are a bourbon person. You're a Scotch person. I mean, those being the two great divides that we get into. And of course, in Scotland, there's no E. In the U.S., there is an E. And so we decided to put the parentheses around the E to say we're agnostic on it, that we love them all. We're about whiskey, however you want to spell it, and to bring people together to craft their own product. And that became our purpose. And as we started to go through it, and when then we find other people want to do this, and it's growing and growing and growing, and it's just a ton of fun. The look on people's faces when they make their own whiskey is just amazing. Now, interestingly, as we started to do this thing, we had no idea what was going to happen, because people said, oh, you're making this stuff fast. There's no story, no legend. People like the heritage. Mm-hmm. But you know what happened is when people made their own whiskey, you know what their story was? Well, I've taken this much of New World, and I took this Old World, and I have some corn, and I have some rye, and I did this because of this. All of a sudden, instead of Johnny, Jimmy, and Jack's whiskey, it's your whiskey. And that became our mission. And it's interesting, because we'll talk with distilleries and they'll say, okay, I want you to make this thing. I go, don't do that. I go, but I want you to just clone. I said, I don't do that. They said, but you can. I said, just because I can doesn't mean I should. And that's a key strategy thing. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. And so our mission is custom whiskey. And, you know, we raised a little bit of money. And I got investors, and I turned down investors who didn't get it. But the investors that got it, they know we're in the custom whiskey business. We're building systems and tools to enable everybody to have their own whiskey, because everybody deserves one. And that's a choice we've made. And to make success in any new business, you got to make that choice. Now, it may change. It may evolve. That's fine. But you got to be able to ask every employee, what do you do here? You know, what's the mission? What's the purpose? And ours is custom.
So paint me a picture here, Doug, of where you're kind of at and where you're going. Everyone deserves their own whiskey. I get it. That's clear in my head. How far does that go from a perspective of, you know, the individual? And then what are the systems and that you have in place so far, and the ones you need to build in order to make that a reality?
Give
me where you are now and where you're going.
So what you do is you come to an event, and it can be held at a restaurant. It can be held at a distillery, bar. There's a do-it-yourself kit that you can do at home and watch videos on the internet. So what we do is we basically deconstruct the whiskey into the four great grains: wheat, corn, rye, and barley. We have people taste in a New World style, you know, the U.S. style, basically, corn, wheat, corn, rye, and barley. Then they taste them in an Old World style, and then they taste in a craft style where we've put the stuff together. And then at the end, having done the tasting and some food here and there in between, they then start to put together their own personal whiskey to their taste. They might want a little bit of Old World with some New World. Maybe throw in a little craft for some zing, and eureka, as we say. They have their own personal whiskey like nobody else's, made exactly to their taste. And I mean, truly different, because all 12 products, you know, sometimes people say to me, they say, Doug, yeah, but, you know, all Scotch tastes the same, or all bourbon tastes the same. Yeah, no, these don't. All 12 products that you taste are really, really different from each other. We've purposely worked on that. And so you really get something that's really pretty magical, and people just love it. They love it. I mean, imagine couples doing it to celebrate their wedding, new babies. I mean, whatever it is.
Birthday.
It's nothing like having, you know, whiskey has a different place in people's lives.
And so Doug, where are you in this process? I mean, if you went to the ranch today, or went to the Brain Brew Whiskey today, would you be able to pull all this off? Do you already have the videos and all that? Where are you kind of in the spectrum of complete product, I guess?
We've got the whole process together. We've done some prototypes. We're going to be doing another prototype coming up. We can't sell today until the government starts back up again and the TTB finishes our labels.
Okay.
We can do a little R&D and some of those kind of things, but we can't sell anything. We have to be very careful about, there's nothing that can be sold. We can do some small experiments and that kind of stuff. And we do have a permit over in Kentucky, where we're working with another distiller that makes a bunch of our products so that we can do the stuff there. But, we're ready. It's just as soon as the government can, they can do that thing we're talking about, which is come together, come together, common mission. Maybe we need Dr. Franklin or Joe to help with this blue card to get these people to come together, because we're all the whole industry is waiting for that, because all of our labels are held up right now. So,
okay. Well, let's move to our cocktail. Now, is this the Dr. Franklin cocktail? Apropos, is this a real thing, or did you guys come up with this drink?
What do you mean, is it a real thing?
Well, I don't ever remember going to a bar, Doug, and ordering a Dr. Franklin.
It's craft, man. We make our own. Of course, it's an original creation.
Okay.
Now, this is an original creation. And I spent way too much time and money creating this, by the way, because I felt a real responsibility. So you hear these recipes every week, but I'm telling you, folks, this one's cool. Not that the others aren't cool, but this one is in particular was kind of fun because I challenged myself to do the founding fathers. Now, for those of you who don't know your history, some of them hung out together. Some of them didn't. Most famously, Franklin and John Adams were at war with each other most of the time. John Adams was a hothead up in Massachusetts. Franklin's trying to calm things down. And as it turned out, and Washington was kind of trying to play peacemaker as the leader of the whole crew, and Jefferson was buddies with Franklin. And well, Franklin and Jefferson, they liked wine, in particular Madeira wine from Portugal, okay, which is a fortified wine. Adams liked hard cider, and Washington was a distiller and famously made rye whiskey. So I said, let's put together Madeira, hard cider, and rye and bring them together so that the sum of the parts, the total is greater than the sum of the parts. In other words, can we make something really wonderful? And so that's what I did. And I kept messing with it. And I ended up with, again, it's in the show notes, 2 ounces of Madeira wine, 1 ounce of hard cider, and then 1 ounce of our noble oak rye. So that's one of our products that we use, Noble Oak Rye. So 2-1-1, and just stir it in ice, and it's just got a richness and a depth to it that is, it's not a Manhattan, but the cider gives it a lightness, the rye gives it a spiciness, and then the Madeira, unlike Cabernet and that, really has a backbone to it that's pretty wonderful. And I did two parts wine because I was going to say, okay, I'm going to give Franklin the lead here. So that's why it's a Madeira. So so that also takes the alcohol down a little bit, not much, but it takes it down a little bit because you get, three different levels of alcohol there. But it's a really, really refreshing drink. And as I ended the newsletter, I said, as we drink this heritage cocktail, give a toast using the words. So I took some of the words of Ben Franklin, stitched them together. And as Franklin said, there cannot be good living where there is no good drinking. I give you this hint as a man of the world. Let us then, with glass in hand, adore the wisdom of the ages. Let us raise our glass and drink. A fine toast to the good doctor.
Very good. And that'd be a great way to end our Brain Brew Whiskey Academy.
Thank you, Trip.
Thank you, Doug. Because we appreciate you as a listener, we are offering for limited time 4 things. A 1-hour abridged audio of the Driving Eureka book. a subscription to the Driving Eureka newsletter, which contains weekly advice from Doug Hall on how to find, filter, and fast-track big ideas. And the newsletter has other offers that are not made public. The Driving Eureka prescription for success: you answer questions and we'll help you assess your ability to find, filter, and fast-track big ideas. And you get advice on how to grow your ability to innovate. And the last item, access to a Doug Hall interview with a radio legend. To get these offers, go to www.DougHall.com/podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to the Driving Eureka podcast on iTunes.